Anyway, okay, yeah, so we're going to talk about The Untouchables today. A very fun, gritty Brian De Palma movie from, what, 1987? I always forget to write down the year.
It is 1987, yes.
Yeah, okay. It is a 83/89 on Rotten Tomatoes. It received 4 Oscar nominations, including a win for Sean Connery for supporting actor. Good movie. Has some very cool lines. And I think it's a lot of early Kevin Smith movies that would have come out, you know, 5 to 10 years after this. Quotes The Untouchables constantly in his movies. You can see him kind of falling in love with this movie and just the dialogue. The lines are iconic in the sense that I recognize them from other people quoting them.
Yeah.
How do you feel about like the dialogue and some of the lines here in The Untouchables?
It is kind of a... I think, you know what, I think I'm just going to start calling this the Casablanca effect, where...
Yeah, okay, there,
a movie has something in it, because we've referenced this so many times, and we always bring up Casablanca as the example.
Right, right.
So I think I'm just going to go ahead and call it the Casablanca effect from now on.
I like it.
Where it, when you're watching it, it's like, man, some of this seems kind of cheesy, kind of corny, a little bit cliche, but a lot of the stuff that you would... think a lot of the reason you think it's cliche is because after this movie came out, that style or those specific lines even are used so many times in movies afterwards that it becomes cliche,
right?
Even though this movie, when it was, you know,
the OG,
the first one,
yeah,
to do it.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. No, it is, as much as this movie has a reputation of like, oh yeah, The Untouchables, so cool, and it is cool, I also kind of feel it's a little overrated. Like, I don't think it holds up the best. Like, it's good, but the pacing is kind of weird. The character arcs are, frankly, weak. And honestly, too, from a history standpoint, we'll also talk about, too, how until the last 10, 15 years, they really didn't care about history when doing movies based on history. And so this movie is mostly made up. And
oh, almost entirely
right.
Made up. Yeah.
So I think that hurts my perception of it too, and it's always kind of bizarre because the movie that always gets the most crap in academic circles, it seems, is, oh, Braveheart, what a joke, so historically inaccurate. Right, it's more accurate than Untouchables. I mean, so
right.
It's, I don't know, maybe it's because Braveheart won Best Picture, but then Gladiator didn't take similar heat when Maximus is a completely fictional character, and...
Right.
At least William Wallace was based on a real person who was drawn and quartered. Oh, spoiler alert.
And I think that's, I don't know, there is kind of a tendency among like history buffs and history movie buffs to conflate the historicity of a movie and its quality.
And I'm guilty of that too. I am guilty of that too.
I'm guilty of it sometimes.
Okay.
But there's also times, and specifically, actually, with Braveheart and Gladiator,
okay,
the historicity of those movies is not great, but those are two of my favorite movies of all time. Like,
I do really
love
like
those
them.
Movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Just The Untouchables, too. A big fan of this movie.
Okay.
I know that this stuff didn't happen.
Okay.
But it's a fun movie to watch.
It is a lot of fun. I still think the pacing is just kind of weird and how Sean Connery goes from, like, not interested to, like, okay, I'm apparently the biggest secret badass ever, and here's how we're going to do this. I'm like, oh, that's
yeah,
cool. Oh, wait, he's just made up. So, like, I don't know. It's like...
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
So, I've had, like, I don't know if I wrote it down in my notes here. It's just like, ah, oh, yes. And at the end, Elliot Ness reflected on all the fictional people that helped him along the way. Okay. It's going to be kind of mostly random notes because it is kind of so fictionalized here. One, the Ennio Morricone, whatever, I don't know how to say his name, score is awesome and fun. And it's kind of like you recognize it before you see his name even too.
Yeah,
he just has that. He's really good at those kind of aggressive staccato rhythms that are
yeah,
constantly kind of upbeat and like suspenseful. Like, I don't know, just there's
yep,
something about those Morricone scores. And then... here's one I bet you didn't look up. So, the baby in the carriage scene, they kind of keep cutting to, he goes down the stairs, it's kind of the homage
right,
to Battleship Potemkin. That baby...
is that somebody famous?
Not famous, but he does work in
oh,
the industry.
Okay.
He does work in the industry still.
Okay.
So, his name is Colin Himes, and he grew up to be a Marine, and now works as a Hollywood stuntman.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So his first stunt was like as an infant.
That is kind of cool. I thought you were going to say like that was Timothy Chalamet or something. Like,
no, probably too old for Chalamet, but yes.
Yeah, good point. Probably too old. But like, you know, I thought you were going to say it was somebody famous, like how is it the baby in The Godfather in the baptism scene? Isn't that Sofia Coppola?
Oh, yes, yes.
Or in Time After Time, the little 2-year-old kid that runs into H.G. Wells in the museum at the beginning is Corey Feldman.
Oh, yep, yep.
I thought it was going to be one of those where the baby like turns out to be someone famous later on.
Sorry. But I thought it was cool he did.
Or more famous. I guess more famous.
Yeah,
No shade to, what was the guy's
Colin Hymes, yeah. Yeah,
Colin Hymes.
And he's a fellow Marine with you. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Okay, so the opening text of the film says, 1930, Prohibition has transformed Chicago into a city at war. Rival gangs compete for control of the city's billion-dollar empire of illegal alcohol, enforcing their will with the hand grenade and the Tommy gun. It is the time of the gang lords. It is the time of Al Capone. And that is true. I would say that opening text is correct. And then the fantasy begins kind of from there. So before I get to Al Capone, I was maybe going to have you, or we can talk first about just how Prohibition went into place, and then maybe even if you had time to look at the temperance movements or any of that kind of stuff. I watched a couple of videos, but I didn't know if you had time to look into the legal side that kind of got us here in the first place.
A little bit. The temperance movement, it was a movement that was born out of a kind of a broader Protestant moral panic that was going around at the time. It goes all the way, temperance itself goes all the way back to like Carrie Nation.
Yes.
And with their hatchet breaking up the bars. And that's way further, that's decades before this movie. That's like the early 20th century.
Right.
But that movement kind of gained steam over the years as issues related to alcohol got worse and worse. Things like, you know, domestic violence, just general laziness. There were a lot of, I watched the Crash Course on, I think it was just on, it wasn't on the temperance movement specifically, but I think it was just on like Reformation movements in the U.S. more broadly. But they talked about the temperance movement. And in that video, John Green said that the rate of alcohol use at that time was 7 gallons a year, which is like double what the average rate is today.
Oh, interesting. So, okay, yeah.
It's like, it's a little bit extreme to like make a amendment to the Constitution to ban alcohol, but they weren't doing it for no reason. Like, alcohol was a big problem, and the mentality behind the movement was, well, if we make, like, true freedom isn't having the choice to have a drink and not. True freedom is, we're going to remove the temptation to drink entirely, just make it illegal. And now you're free to be sober.
Mm.
Like that, we will set you free kind of thing.
Interesting.
Because those movements, not just temperance, but those moral movements in general had the mentality, the ideology of, it's not enough for me just to live my own life righteously. I have to make sure that my community is, you know, living a righteous life as well, whether they want to or not, because it's for their own eternal good.
I watched a video by Oversimplified about the whole movement, and it was talking about a few different things. I also listened to a podcast about Carrie Nation, kind of just talking about how women's role, because women couldn't vote until, you know, like, what, 1920. So, like, the women's role was kind of like to take care of the homes. And so a lot of times women might be blamed for alcoholic husbands, like, oh, you're not keeping him happy because he has to drink.
Yeah.
But then you also have divorces are a lot hard to get. So if your husband is a drunk and abusive, you are stuck in that relationship. So basically, both from getting blamed for and being victims of the abuse of alcohol, women were the ones then that kind of spearheaded these temperance movements to, it kind of, in their role, because like, so the podcast I was listening to talked about how, hey, if you're saying women are in charge of the morality at home, well, now because that's our role, we're saying you need to get rid of alcohol if you want better morality in a better country, and exactly.
And
so that kind of, it's kind of spearheading those movements,
and it was, there was a connection too with, you know, if you have a, if you're a woman and your husband is just constantly drunk all the time, especially if he's drunk, and because he's drunk, he's not working, not contributing to the home, then you and your kids have to pick up the slack. And so then it's like, well, my husband's, you know, just drunk all the time. He's useless. So now I have to work. Right. Now my kids have to work just for us to be able to make ends meet. And that's kind of bullshit. So, like, hubby, you're off the sauce now because the kids don't want to go work in a factory anymore.
So the podcast about Carrie Nation is actually a show called Make History Dope Again that is by a few Wichita history teachers. And I have not...
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, I have not met them or talked to them or anything online here yet, but another track coach mentioned, like, oh, hey, you do a podcast. Well, there's these other Wichita history guys that do a podcast. So I'm like, so that kind of got me to pull theirs up, and the episodes I actually chose to watch were, or listen to, were them talking about Carrie Nation.
Do they do, like, Kansas-specific history? Because Carrie Nation's from Kansas, isn't she?
Yes, she's from Kansas. Yes, they do a lot of local-focused stuff, but not exclusively.
Okay.
But the episode that was recommended to me that I have not listened to yet is apparently they do, like, a whole, like, three-part thing digging into segregation and redlining, all this kind of that kind of stuff in Wichita in like the 1930s, and kind of really like deep diving into the city's history of various things. Like, actually, the one thing that this other coach mentioned to me was that South High's mascot used to be the Colonels, and their logo was like a Southern Confederate Colonel kind of thing. And then it's like, wait, what? We were a free state, but yep, yeah, didn't matter, and just kind of. Some of those kinds of things. So I guess there's something I hadn't thought about either when they were talking about Carrie Nation, and who, again, I've driven by her house in Medicine Lodge because it's like a museum today, and I've never stopped in. Mm. I really didn't know anything about her other than the name and the axe, and like I really did. That was actually about the extent of my knowledge of Carrie Nation. Was, yeah, she's some lady that didn't like drinking and had an axe. So
yeah,
what I failed to realize was before National Prohibition, various states and localities had their own prohibition or not. Like we talked about with Sergeant York and how Kentucky was dry and Tennessee wasn't, or the other way around. Tennessee was dry and Kentucky wasn't. So they had the border bars. Like, well, that's pre-prohibition, but Kentucky had prohibition. Or sorry, Tennessee had prohibition. I keep saying the wrong one. So yeah, either all of Kansas or part of Kansas, I think it was all of Kansas, was actually dry at the time too, and it was illegal there. So what she was doing, she kind of got fed up in all the ways we were talking about, and said, "Screw it, I'm just gonna go down and literally destroy the local bars." So she would just go in with a group of women, and they would tear the place apart. And guess what? It was an illegal saloon, so you couldn't do anything. What are you gonna do? Call the police? It's an illegal saloon, and so. Right. She would get arrested, but then they had to let her go immediately. So she was going all over the state, eventually with a hatchet, tearing down, literally just like destroying bars and saloons and places where men were drinking, and they couldn't do much about it because they were illegal operations. It'd be like if the police weren't going after meth labs, that the local community was just rising up and going to destroy the meth labs. Difference being, it was kind of like what we see in the 20s, where everyone was still drinking anyway. It didn't matter if it was illegal, and so most people didn't necessarily consider it a crime.
Technically, the drinking booze never was illegal. It was the manufacture...
Under prohibition, right. I don't know what the laws were before that in different localities, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure. There might have actually been consumption laws, like, at the state level, but I'm saying when the 18th Amendment was passed, it was manufacture, transport, and sale was all illegal.
Right. Consumption was not illegal. Right. So if you were found drunk, you weren't necessarily in... Or it's actually public drunkenness is still a crime today in most places, right? Like if you're just walking around drunk.
Yeah, but that's usually like just being drunk isn't necessarily the crime. It's the disorder that you create while you're drunk is the issue. Yeah.
Okay. And then the other thing that the video on YouTube by Oversimplified discussed... was, and I forget the guy's name, but he was saying it almost becomes like this single issue voter kind of thing where there's actually just became a huge push for the national prohibition stuff. And like they were just, so nationally, it wasn't necessarily super popular, but it was enough of a niche issue that you could get people to, like, basically, hey, you're going to be for prohibition, right? You're not? Then we're going to put all our money behind your primary opponent who is going to push prohibition. And they were doing that all over the country. So it was actually just a very targeted one-issue movement to get all the politicians elected who were going to be for prohibition and to railroad anybody who wasn't for prohibition, so that when you get it passed, you basically just had a Congress that was not representative of the mood of the country necessarily.
That sounds a lot like how something like abortion works, in recent history, where you would have like all these, a relatively small group, but a very politically powerful group, because they were so focused on it, would all be single issue voters, and then you could get, you know, politicians elected who represented, you know, technically democratically unpopular views.
Right. It was, and probably still is, a Republican litmus test that if you're not pro-choice, you can't get a Republican nomination. Yet then when these red states put it on the ballot, it overwhelmingly goes against pro-life movements. And so it's kind of fascinating. It actually was almost even shocking when Kansas and Ohio and places like that have, it's just so... Anyway, that's kind of a whole side note where I'm like, how is this? I thought I knew so many people that were single issue voters, and that the only reason you can't win in Kansas as a Democrat is because every Republican is pro-life and you just can't be pro-choice in Kansas and never get elected. And yet then when they put it on the ballot, the whole state's like, oh yeah, we're pro-choice. I'm like, wait, what? So basically there was thousands and thousands and thousands of Kansans that voted for Donald Trump and then turned around and voted to protect abortion rights. I'm like, what? Like, the cognitive dissonance there is just kind of baffling to me. But anyway, we don't need to go into abortion here. We'll stick with prohibition.
If you want to hear more about abortion, check out our episode on...
on 4 weeks, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days.
Yeah. That's the one.
Yep.
I knew it was 4-3-2, but I didn't remember if it was...
Well, it's got to be the one that fits in a gestation cycle. So starting with 4 months is about the only one that makes sense.
That's the Romanian one that we did, right?
Yes. Yep.
That movie was depressing as fuck.
Yeah. So yes, ultimately then you do get Congress passing the 18th Amendment in, what was it? It was actually early on in 1919. I don't actually have those notes in front of me. And then they later passed the Volstead Act in the fall of that year to give it teeth, because basically the 18th Amendment just said, hey, no more alcohol based on all the things you were saying. And then the Volstead Act basically said, here's how we're going to implement across the country. Like, here's the plan to actually put the 18th Amendment into effect.
Correct.
And then that went into effect. Yeah. Was it then like basically January 1, 1920? Was that like the go date for the Volstead Act?
So the 18th Amendment was proposed at the end of 1917 and then was ratified in January of 1919.
Okay.
And then the Volstead Act was January 1920.
Okay. So, and again, as now we have the benefit of hindsight, although, I mean, well, and I say you're like, oh, you should know, it's going to be obvious. Anyway, so you outlaw something, you give the power to the criminals to then now control that market. So if the market is no longer legal, and it's kind of inevitable that it's going to continue when something like drinking is so popular. Oh, the other thing that, too, we didn't mention is that apparently a lot of people, and I don't think this is even the public, I think maybe even some of the people in Congress voting on the legislation didn't realize when they voted in favor of prohibition that it also included beer.
Oh, really?
they just thought it was going to be for hard stuff. And so anyway...
That's kind of
right,
funny.
So because of that, like, wait, beer's illegal too? And so people were going to continue drinking, and now that it's an illegal business, the mob and people who are willing to deal with these illegal markets and illegal products now have all the power and get crazy rich. So yes, Al Capone, as it mentioned in the opening text of the film, is kind of the face of the illegal alcohol trade in not just Chicago, in the country. And actually, a lot of that's because he was, as we kind of see in the movie, he did like talk to the press and was a notable figure, which was kind of unique,
right?
And in retrospect, kind of foolish, which is why you don't see mob bosses being well known today. They want to keep a low profile. Al Capone kept a high profile, and you could argue that's kind of was maybe to his detriment. So a few things I thought were crazy off the bat. So In 1930, when the film starts, Al Capone was 31 years old.
Really?
Yes.
And Elliot Ness was only 27.
That's crazy. So yeah, so these guys are basically too old. So yeah, so Al Capone, Robert De Niro was like 13 years too old to play Al Capone in 1930, which isn't crazy old, but this young-looking De Niro was actually too old for Capone at the time. So yeah, and he was only the boss of Chicago here for 7 years. It was just a 7-year window. It just happened to be like the heyday when he was in charge.
Right.
So Al Capone was born in Brooklyn to Italian immigrants in 1899. He had 8 siblings. His oldest brother actually ended up later changing his last name because he became a prohibition agent. So Capone is probably not the best name if you're a prohibition agent.
That's funny.
Al was a bright enough student, but he did kind of always have problems with authority. He was expelled at the age of 14 for hitting a female teacher in the face.
Oof.
But overall, he was pretty much just a normal teen of the time. Worked odd jobs, played a few years of semi-pro baseball. Got married to a woman named May Coughlin when he was 19, right after she gave birth to their son. But he did run around in the same Five Points area that we talked about in Gangs of New York. I guess it hadn't yet been, We mentioned in Gangs of New York that area's kind of been, it's just been redesigned. Like, it doesn't exist anymore just because of construction over the decades. But
right, all the buildings got, right, eventually went away.
Yeah, apparently it was still around when Capone was little. Even though that was about 40, 50 years after Gangs of New York. But he was involved with some of those very same gangs that come up in Gangs of New York, like the later versions of them. So like he ran around with the 40 Thieves and the Bowery Boys. And
that's kind of cool.
Just kind of crazy to think of Capone still being part of that world. He was working as a bouncer when he, quote, inadvertently insulted a woman. And I put it in quotes just because I don't know why Wikipedia mentioned it was inadvertent. I'm guessing he may have just said something, not realizing how offensive it was to her. I don't have the details beyond that. But her brother got mad and sliced Capone's face with a knife, leaving scars on the left side that would kind of define him forever and give him the nickname Scarface that he hated. He was super self-conscious about these the rest of his life. So you think a gangster would always be like priding themselves on the scars. Like, no, he hated it. You couldn't call him Scarface to his face. In pictures, he always tried to hide that side of his face so the scars wouldn't be visible. Like, he was very self-conscious about it. His mentor in the criminal world was a man named Johnny Torrio, another Italian guy running the streets in New York who was 17 years older than Capone. Torrio moved to Chicago in 1919, and then Capone later followed him for, you know, quote, career opportunities. So they're both in Chicago now. There's something called the Chicago Outfit, which is kind of like the name for the mob. But what I didn't realize was it wasn't necessarily an official name, but it's like capital O Outfit. So I think every time I had heard them like reference the Outfit in like mob movies and stuff, I just thought it was like a general term. It was actually more of a specific term for the Chicago. Yeah, so like it's the capital O Outfit. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Huh.
Although it had other names probably too. And I don't like they had like, it's not like they were a registered LLC or whatever. But
yeah.
So the Outfit was founded in 1910 by Big Jim Colosimo, who was murdered 10 years later in 1920. Possibly suspiciously not long after Capone arrived in Chicago. Now, we don't know for sure, but Capone may have been involved in his murder, but no one was ever charged. And it was Capone's Torrio who took over the Outfit after Colosimo's death. So, a little suspicious, but, you know, obviously Torrio was working under Colosimo. And then, anyway, so Torrio's now in charge. And then, of course, that's all about the same time that Prohibition goes into effect is when Torrio takes over the Outfit. So Torrio's in charge with Capone as his right-hand man, and they're just getting everything booming with bootlegging and the illegal alcohol trade, and they're just, it's almost like good news. Prohibition's good news for the mobsters, because now all the legal outlets for selling alcohol just got shut down. We're going to be rich, because everyone's still going to be drinking. Yeah, so the Outfit just seems to have been good at using force to maintain their business control on the city, while also avoiding, for the most part, full-on gang wars. And a lot of times the outfit might be the group that would mediate conflicts between other gangs. That kind of all helps them rise to the top and become like the top gang. Obviously, that's a gross oversimplification, as always. But it is kind of the normal Sopranos type stuff where you're taking out rivals and there are hits here and there. And there's disagreements over turf and all that. But they are kind of top dog in Chicago. In 1925, Torrio was shot several times in like one incident. He didn't die, but that was enough to be like, you know what? I think I'm going to step back. Al, you're in charge. So 1925 is when Capone takes over the outfit at 26 years old.
Jeez.
Which is just crazy.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah, by the time we see 1930 come around, he'd only been in charge of the outfit for 5 years. Which also kind of maybe if you see the media, so I would say that opening scene of the film where it's kind of them, all the media people talking to Capone like he's a celebrity and he's just kind of hamming it up and talking about, hey, I'm just a businessman. And that vibe actually is fairly accurate. He was a pretty popular figure in the media. He wasn't afraid to talk to reporters. He would often say, hey, I'm just a businessman feeling the need. So like, even if that specific stuff at the beginning of the film isn't, you know, straight out of a specific incident, that is the correct vibe for who Al Capone was. And he was kind of charismatic. And the city kind of liked him. He was like, hey, we're all drinking anyway. And Al makes it possible. Like, they weren't anti-Al Capone as much as he was kind of this thug ruling with violence.
Well, and because he's not like a serial killer. I mean, he had a bunch of people killed, obviously. He ruled through violence. But he's... If you're just a random person in Chicago, you have no reason to be afraid of Al Capone.
Right, right.
You're the customer. He's not going after you. And if you like drinking beer or whiskey, like, that's your guy. So, of course, they're going to be probably completely fine. It's like, yeah, even if they knew he was violent, it's like, yeah, but, like, not to me.
Right.
Not to anyone that I know. Not to anyone that I actually care about.
Right.
Like, it's just criminals.
Yep, and well, for the most part, we see that explosion at the beginning of the film, where they set the bomb in the place that wouldn't buy from them.
Right.
And again, not a specific incident, but that is the kind of thing that would happen. So, places that wouldn't buy from them.
Yeah, stuff like that was going on for sure.
Yes, yes. But again, that's not necessarily mainstream enough to turn the whole city against him. The Canadian connection to get illegal liquor from Canada, that is true as far as like, they were getting a lot of alcohol from Canada. The whole confrontation we see on the border, that was all made up for the movie.
Wait, you're telling me that there wasn't actually an interrogation where they picked up a dead guy and shot him in the face to get the other guy to talk? You're telling me that was made up?
There's no armed conflict between the agents and the bootleggers at the Canadian border. That didn't happen. Yep. Okay. So the one line, though, I thought was good. So this one is not in the film, but again, just to kind of give you an idea of Capone's personality. So when these things are brought up, Capone gives the typical wise guy answer of, I don't even know which street Canada is on.
Yeah.
So yeah, very much kind of the stereotype we know him as. Yeah, he was attacked by rival gangs and he'd take out their leaders, all that kind of stuff. So the mob, though, of course, as we kind of see vaguely in the film, again, the specifics in the film are all fictionalized, but they did need friends in the government. So there was one William Hale Thompson running for mayor who told the people of Chicago, hey, I am not really interested in pushing to enforce prohibition. Like, it's not on my agenda as far as what needs to go on. And I'm not going to be bringing in the hammer on prohibition. So Capone puts a lot of money behind making sure he gets elected mayor so they won't have as much pressure from City Hall kind of on their case. Also puts a lot of violence behind making sure Hale Thompson gets elected. So like they would bomb voting locations in areas where Thompson was the underdog. In the April 1928 primary election, 15 people were killed at the polls because Capone's thugs were like bombing voting locations to ensure a Thompson victory. We mentioned he was a folk killer despite that. The public sentiment or support did shift away from Capone after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929. Which we'll dive more into that if and when we get to Some Like It Hot, because that's kind of based around a fictionalized version of that massacre.
Yeah.
But that was enough of a public, oh, hey, yeah, it's one thing if he's secretly knocking off people here and there and we really don't know about it, but this is like front page. He's allowed that his men lined up a bunch of people and murdered them. Like, that's probably not cool, and that's like, we don't like that chaos, and like, it's making it now, right. Now the city looks scary. That's not cool. Maybe this Capone guy isn't the best guy to have basically in charge of the city. He really did the dirty work himself. Like, he was in Florida, I think, when the Valentine's Day massacre happened. But in the film, they show that him kind of take out the baseball bat and clubs that guy to death for messing up or whatever.
Yeah.
That in particular is made up. But there was a version where apparently a few guys were plotting to overthrow Capone. And he beat the three of them with a baseball bat and then ordered his men to shoot them.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Getting it done himself in that instance.
That's right. Man of action. So, following that, and actually, so as that massacre does kind of get the ball rolling to get all the heat brought on him here. So, in 1929, following the St. Valentine's Day massacre, some in Chicago are now asking DC for help, basically saying, hey, Chicago's essentially being run by the gangs and the mob here. We need federal assistance to get this under control. And then that's when federal agents are sent in from both the Treasury and Justice Departments, and they are seen as kind of incorruptible by the normal corruption methods known in Chicago, and were dubbed untouchables by the Chicago Daily News. So why don't you, before I kind of finish up Capone here, why don't you bring in Elliot Ness and everything that was brought into Chicago to kind of help deal with this situation?
So Elliot Ness was the leader of the federal agents that were brought in. He was born in 1903 in Chicago, so he is actually,
oh, okay,
you know, a local guy.
Yeah. It film makes it seem the other way around. Like, Capone's local and he's from the outside. It's actually kind of the opposite.
Right, yeah. I'd be curious to see, because nowadays, you know, federal agents, like, if you sign up to be in the FBI, you can go anywhere, you know, just with any federal agency.
Okay.
I wonder if back then it was a lot more common, even if you were working for the feds, to kind of stay local to where you lived or where you grew up. But he was born in 1903. Both of his parents were Norwegian immigrants. He went to high school and college in Chicago. He graduated from the University of Chicago in 1925 and then started working as a credit investigator for the retail credit company of Atlanta, and was in their Chicago office just investigating people for credit. In 1929, he got a second degree in criminology and then went to work for the federal government. His brother-in-law was an agent of the BOI, which later became the FBI, and he was the one who actually, he was the reason why Elliot Ness went into law enforcement.
Okay.
And so he joins the Treasury Department in 1926 and starts working for the Bureau of Prohibition, which kind of then is the precursor to, like, the ATF today.
Oh, okay.
The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Yeah. So yeah, the film makes it seem like he came in from Washington, D.C. to move into Chicago to help. But I guess he already had a house, though. So I guess, what is the implication in the movie? That he already lived in Chicago and is now there to help? Or he did move in from D.C.?
Yeah, I don't, because they say he's brought in. But I wonder if they meant like, oh, he got brought on to the investigation. Like, they're making him the head of the investigation.
That makes more sense, since they kind of already had a house and we don't really get this vibe that they moved.
Right.
Okay, so I just, yeah.
Yeah.
I incorrectly interpreted that as he moved to Chicago, but they already had a house.
Yeah, I thought it was implied that he was being, when they say he's being brought in, like, oh, we're bringing in this specialist from out of town, but it's not.
He's a federal agent, so yeah. Okay.
Right, but they never say that, and he does have the house already.
Huh.
So, yeah, maybe that was just a misread on my part.
Well, me too, though.
Yeah, but so the agents were from the Bureau of Prohibition, and then there were other agents from the Bureau of Internal Revenue, which later is the IRS.
Okay.
So it's basically the precursor organizations to the FBI, the ATF, in the IRS.
And yeah, crazy how young he is, though, to your point there, that even as young as I thought Capone was, like, Ness is even younger. And which also though, leads
27.
To the film kind of showing him being naive to start actually works a lot better if you realize. Not that, I mean, actually, I think Costner's probably in his late 30s at this time, but like that naivety or whatever is, I don't know, maybe more, not believable, because it was definitely believable with Costner here, but almost sillier, like it's, or more embarrassing, because they even kind of tease him in the film behind his back for saying, like, let's do some good before they kind of do that first raid. And they're just mocking him. But like, if that's a, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed 27-year-old agent, like, and his first gig, that naivety is, like, even more pointed, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. So Costner was, he's born in, I just looked it up, he's born in 1955. So he would have been 32
when the movie came out. Okay, wow. Okay.
So not crazy
about
old.
The same.
But
yeah.
Because they cast De Niro as Capone, it makes it look like there's that big age gap between Capone and Ness. And Capone is, I don't even know if he calls him a kid,
but he
does kind of, you get the vibe that Capone is like, oh, like this
uncle,
you know,
figure,
like you said, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, like naive, like little boy is coming after me. It's like they were only 4 years apart in age. But anyway, so because of everything that you were just talking about, in 1930, the president, Herbert Hoover, kind of says we need to get Chicago under control. We need to start really, you know, hammering down on these prohibition violations. And so the U.S. Attorney George Johnson picks Ness to lead the investigative team to stop Capone. He forms the group known as the Untouchables by going through, like, painstakingly combing through all the records of all these different agents, and ends up picking 10 guys.
Okay.
So more than in the movie, but not as, I figured, okay, there probably was more people involved in this, but in movies, you can only have so many characters that the audience is going to be able to keep track of. So you, a lot of times, do have to, you know, condense or make characters that are actually amalgamations of multiple different people. So I figured the group was bigger, but I thought it was probably a lot bigger than just 10 guys.
Yeah, yeah.
But the real life Untouchables was, it was only 10 dudes. They began doing raids in 1931 and put a pretty sizable dent in the bootlegging operations around, in and around Chicago. Wikipedia says within 6 months they had destroyed an estimated $500,000 worth of illegal alcohol operations, and that's $9.9 million.
In today's money?
In today's money.
Yeah, wow. So yeah, Capone was rightfully angry, or justifiably angry, yeah.
Yes. The reason that the group was known as the Untouchables is because they were seen as being immune to bribery. So in 1931, it doesn't say who, but it says just a member of Al Capone's gang told Ness that he could get $2,000 a week if he just looked the other way.
Basically, just be lazy, just be shitty at your job, and we'll pay you off. Yeah.
Right. Which $2,000 a week doesn't sound like a ton of money, but that's over $36,000, almost $37,000 today. Every week, we'll give you $37,000 a week.
Oh, wow.
To just ignore what's going on, just leave us alone.
Right. You can still put on a good show. Yeah.
Yep. And he said no. So there was a journalist, Charles Schwartz, who coined the term Untouchables, and that became the nickname for their squad.
Nice.
So they massively damaged Capone's operations, and he was indicted in June of 1931 for, it says, 5,000 violations of the Volstead Act. And then the judge actually, instead of pursuing the trial for the Volstead Act violations, pursued the tax evasion case instead.
Okay.
So it wasn't like, I feel like the way that they portrayed in the movie is, well, we'll never get him on the alcohol stuff.
Oh,
that's
right.
Why we have to go after the tax stuff. In real life, they were doing both,
right.
And they actually did bring an indictment on the prohibition violations.
Right.
But it was the judge who decided we're not doing a trial for that. We're going to do a trial for the tax stuff. I don't know if that was because maybe he thought it was going to be harder to, maybe their case wasn't as strong, or I don't know if, well, I would imagine that if he was in the pocket of Capone, he probably wouldn't have let any of that go forward. But I'm not sure why, if it was a strength of the case thing, or even just a public support thing. Like, well, if we just go after the tax stuff, that's a little bit easier, you know, publicly to defend than going after him for prohibition stuff, which the public kind of had a broad disdain for anyway.
I did see something about, and I don't know if this is the exact same incident, but something about they had a deal with the judge and the judge went back on the deal and left Capone's lawyers at the last minute unprepared. That could be what you're talking about, maybe. Like they were going to go one way with it, and then the judge kind of pulls the rug out from underneath them, and all of a sudden they don't even have a case ready. So maybe that was the connection there.
But in any case, he was convicted, Al Capone was convicted on 3 of the 22 counts of tax evasion that they took him to trial for and got sentenced to 11 years in prison. And this led to the only actual real-life meeting between Elliot Ness and Al Capone.
Oh.
It was in May of 1932, and it wasn't like Ness went to go say, I got you, and you're going to jail.
Or stay away from my family!
Right, exactly. He was just one of the group of, there was a whole group of agents, and he was just one that was picked to help move Capone from the Cook County Jail to the train station where they were going to take him to Atlanta to the federal prison.
Huh.
And that's the only time that Ness actually met in person. The only time that is documented and known, which I feel like others, they would have been documented. Like Ness would have said, he would have written a report or something if he ever met Al Capone at any point during the investigation. But in real life, they only met one time, and it was in 1932 after Capone had already been convicted.
Yeah, so actually, let me jump to the bottom here where Wikipedia talks about the specific inaccuracies. I'm just going to read this part of this quote here. So it says, while the film is based on historic events, most of the film is inaccurate or fictional. The raid at the Canada-US border never happened, and neither did the courthouse or railway station shootouts. Ness did not kill Needy, who we'll talk about here. And Ness's unit had very little to do with Capone's final tax evasion conviction. So is that, so like, Ness is doing the stuff against Prohibition, but he's not necessarily involved in bringing Capone down himself, right?
Correct. Because he was a Prohibition agent. He wasn't,
right,
he was a Prohibition agent. He wasn't a tax guy.
Right. So he's not even involved. So the movie, just kind of like says, we're going to make it this rivalry between these two guys. And it's like, it really wasn't. Like, they were on opposite sides, yes, but they weren't even in the same circles, I guess, so to speak, huh?
Yeah. So I'll wrap up Ness real quick,
okay,
because he only lives to be 54.
Oh,
so
okay.
We don't have that much that much more left. And it's actually kind of sad the rest of his life, to be honest.
Huh.
It's kind of interesting. He's almost an anti Wyatt Earp. So in Wyatt Earp's case, and I mean that from a
invincible standpoint,
interestingness and research thing. So like when we talk about Wyatt Earp, it's like, oh yeah, all the stuff, you know, you see in Tombstone, that's just scratching the surface of Wyatt Earp. He did so much more cool stuff before and after. Like there's so much to learn with Ness. This is pretty much it. And a lot of the cool stuff, the quote unquote cool stuff, was made up for the movie.
So is it just that they just used the name, basically? They just needed a figurehead, and so that's, hey, Elliot Ness was in charge. Let's use him as our hero.
Right. Yeah.
And he really was kind of boring.
So after the Al Capone trial, he does get a promotion. He's the chief investigator for the Prohibition Bureau in Chicago. But then that position obviously goes away in 1933 when the 21st Amendment is ratified that repeals the 18th Amendment, which at time of recording is the only amendment of the Constitution to be repealed.
Oh, huh. Okay.
Is the 18th Amendment.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if we've talked about this on air before, but the reason that I remember it's the 21st Amendment.
There's like bars and stuff?
Well, there's a 21st Amendment Brewing Company in California.
Yeah.
And so that's how I remember. And they're named after the 21st Amendment.
Right.
That repealed the 18th that made alcohol legal again. So that's why I remember this, the 21st,
yeah,
21st
yeah.
Amendment. So in 1933, that position goes away. So instead, he gets assigned to the Moonshine Mountains. So Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee area, that, you know, Mountain Dew,
right,
and like illegal moonshine stills. That's where he is transferred, you know, after Prohibition is over.
Wait, but so if Prohibition is over, what's the problem? Or those places are still making illegal alcohol, even though alcohol is illegal, because they're doing it wrong. They're not.
Right. So even though alcohol is legal, those stills are still in violation of the law. I think it's probably a tax thing.
It could be a safety thing, right? Or a tax thing.
A safety thing. In this specific, I think it's a tax thing because it says he's an alcohol tax agent.
Oh, you're circumventing. You're basically not a registered distillery, so we got to shut you down.
Correct. Think about like today in states where it's legal to grow marijuana, you still can't just grow marijuana and sell it to people just willy-nilly.
Because then you're cutting the government out of their tax share. Yeah.
Exactly, because the government needs their slice. So that's why they don't like it.
So that's what Ness was doing after Prohibition was repealed. Okay.
Correct. Yeah. So he transferred to Cleveland, Ohio in 1934, and then in 1935 he leaves the Bureau of leaves the federal law enforcement world and is hired by the city of Cleveland to be the safety director and is put in charge of the police and fire department in Cleveland. It says he had some reform ideas and declared war on the mob, had a couple more run-ins with some other mobsters. Their names in the Wikipedia page: Big Angelo Bernardo, Little Angelo, Skirka? I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
Medium Angelo.
Joe Angarola, George Angersola, and Charles Polizzi. I'm guessing those are all Italian guys.
Probably.
But yeah, so he is trying to clean up the city. He is the he's a safety director at the time that the Cleveland Torso murders took place.
Oof, which sounds bad.
To this day, still unsolved.
They don't know whose torso it was?
Actually, correct. Most of the victims, they don't even know who they are.
I was kidding! Ah!
Because he almost exclusively murdered, like, drifters and homeless people. And this is during the Great Depression, so it was, like, pretty easy to prey on...
Oh, wow.
...like, vulnerable poor people. And bodies would show up, chopped up, torsos cut in half, heads cut off.
What the heck?
And this is 1935, 1938, yeah. I think is when the last body was found. You know, forensics is not awesome back then. It's almost 100 years ago.
Right.
So that investigation, he was never led the investigation, but he was in charge of public safety at the time that the murders were taking place.
Huh.
And that was never solved. He divorced from his first wife in 1938.
Patricia Clarkson.
Yeah, yeah. In real life, the wife's name is Edna. What was her name in the movie?
Did they even change that?
I think they did.
I don't know if he ever referred to her by name.
Yeah, they called her Catherine.
That's so weird. Back in the days when movies just changed anything and they didn't care.
Yeah, yeah. This was the Untouchables was Patricia Clarkson's first movie.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. I guess she was a stage actor before, okay, but that
yeah,
was...
Yeah, yeah.
That was her first movie.
Huh. Yeah, she's good.
But anyway, so Elliot Ness divorced Patricia Clarkson in 1938. It says that the direct quote from the Wikipedia is, otherwise successful career in Cleveland withered gradually, which, yeah, it started out, you know, he's like Mr. Big Shot guy who helped take down Al Capone, and then he's guy who is pretty unsuccessful at cleaning up the streets and also can't solve the serial killer case. And also, in response to the serial killer who's like murdering a bunch of poor people in the shanty towns, Elliot Ness's idea of a solution for that was, we'll just kick everyone out of the shanty towns and burn them to the ground. And then if there's nobody in the shanty towns, no one can get murdered there.
Wow.
Problem solved.
Pragmatist.
So yeah, he was not doing great. After his divorce, and because his professional life was in shambles, he started drinking very heavily.
I was just going to say, oh my gosh, does he become an alcoholic? Oh my God.
Yep, he does. Big time. Big-time alcoholic. He gets in a DUI, a DUI wreck, no less.
Wow.
And not he didn't run into anybody else. I think he just crashed his car while he was drinking. But, you know, that doesn't look good that your director of public safety is getting drunk and crashing his car into stuff. That's not publicly safe at all. So the public is like calling for his firing from the mayor, but the mayor keeps him on anyway. In 1939, he marries another woman named Evelyn, and they move to Washington, D.C., where he goes back to work for the federal government, this time combating prostitution rather than alcohol use. Hmm. Because apparently at that time, STDs were a big issue on military bases. And so it was like a medical issue and a national security issue that all these like military members are going off base and, you know, soliciting prostitutes and then getting STDs.
Right.
So big issue. So between then and 1944, he tries to start a few businesses that none of them get off the ground. And then he goes to become the chairman of a security company called the Diebold Corporation that's based in Ohio. That's in 1944. He gets divorced again and then gets married again in 1946. And then in 1947, runs for the mayor of Cleveland.
Huh.
And he is not elected. He leaves the Diebold Corporation in 1951 and starts taking odd jobs to keep making ends meet, including, it says, a bookstore clerk, a wholesaler of electronic parts, and frozen hamburger patties.
Huh.
So, you know.
Just taking whatever job he can get. Yeah.
That's, that is, to his credit, a very unique job description. What do? I sell electronics and frozen hamburgers.
You gotta cook the hamburgers somehow. They're frozen.
I guess. So he, what's that called? Vertical integration. Yeah,
Yeah.
In 1956, it says he went to go work for a startup called Guarantee Paper Corporation, which claimed to have a new method of watermarking that would prevent counterfeiting. And Elliot Ness went to work for them because of his, you know, treasury and law enforcement expertise, and moves to Pennsylvania to work for this company. And it turns out that the company was basically making up the fact that they had this new process, basically old watermarking process that everyone was using. The company fell apart, and Ness at that time was basically spending all of his free time drinking anyway. It says, and this is like the saddest part to me. It said Ness spent his free time at the local bar telling stories about his law enforcement career. So he was basically just a drunk trying to relive his glory days by telling stories of the time that he was taking down Al Capone. And he's in his 50s at this point.
Which he really didn't even do directly.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, after the business went under, Ness was basically completely broke and basically had no money at the time of his death in 1957. It said he died of a heart attack in 1957. He was 54 years old. His body was cremated, but there is a kind of a monument, a cenotaph, I guess is the word.
Oh, huh.
Which I didn't know that word, but it's used here on the...
I haven't heard it.
It's basically a gravestone or like a memorial, but the person isn't buried there.
Okay.
So he was cremated, but there's a cenotaph at the Lakeview Cemetery in Cleveland, Ohio. And he never had any kids, but he did adopt one kid.
Huh.
So he never had any biological kids. Like, so the baby that we see in the movie...
is fictional, too. Wow.
Both of them. Yeah. Both of them fictional. Yep.
But again, that one I almost kind of get, because you got to increase the stakes in the film. But it's like, so yeah, they're threatening the kids that didn't exist.
Right. Elliot Ness has been portrayed in like a ton of movies and TV shows over the years. And something that I think he would appreciate, being both a being both a prohibition agent and a notable drunk, He has a beer named after him from the Great Lakes Brewing Company in Cleveland. They have a beer called the Elliot Ness. It's an amber lager, if anyone's into that.
So, actually, I didn't look. So is the Untouchables based on a book?
That I don't know. Let me look. I would be surprised if it is, because it's not.
Oh, because it's so made. Well, yeah, it has to be based off a novel, I guess, then, if it was based off a book, right? Because it's so fictionalized.
Yeah, and there was, so like there's a 1959 TV series called The Untouchables too. And there was a, oh, okay, this says there was a book published in 1957 after he died that's called The Untouchables. Oh, okay, yeah, the book inspired popular TV series which ran from 1959 to 1963 and the 1987 film. So there is a, so there is a book. Oh, it's even written by Elliot Ness.
Ooh, that's almost, wait, what?
Okay, hold up. It says, autobiographical memoir by Elliot Ness, co-written by Oscar Fraley, published in 1957 after Elliot Ness died.
Well, I guess my question that I was getting at was, how did he become the poster boy for, you know, like, it's like heroic Elliot Ness taking down the Chicago mob, and it's just like, I mean, yeah, kind of, but not really. Like, it's just, that's just not who he was. I don't want to call him a loser after the fact, but he did not live up to the potential he may have shown in his late 20s, I guess, maybe the kind way to say it. So I'm just trying to figure out at what point he became the poster boy, but it's apparently because he wrote his own book, and that became popular and inspired these other things. Yeah, so he almost has a reputation you could argue he doesn't deserve. He's just not who we think he is in popular culture. Not that he wasn't helping in Chicago, but...
So he wrote this book with another writer in 1957 that sells 1.5 million copies, and then that book is then adapted into a TV show in the 50s and 60s that is apparently very popular, even though I didn't know that existed. And then the book and the show inspired the movie...
Gotcha.
...in 1987, which was also super popular, so that's... That's probably why today...
Elliot Ness, yeah.
We know...
Yeah.
Or we think of Elliot Ness as the, you know, the daring prohibition
agent. Right, so we actually are more... So we basically know the pop culture icon. The actual guy was not that. Because everything's been so fictionalized. Okay.
Right.
And that's not uncommon, I'm sure. So wrapping up Capone, so the movie... actually leaves out that when the movie starts in 1930, Capone actually just got out of a one-year prison sentence. So he was kind of in and out of trouble with the law. It's not like he was untouchable and then they finally get him on tax evasion. He was in and out. They're always trying to figure out something they could, you know, charge him with. So he was actually initially in trouble for contempt of court. Because they were trying to, you know, they were kind of calling up a grand jury for him violating prohibition stuff, like you were saying. And he just kind of is a no-show to that, feigns illness. So they kind of hold him, you know, liable for contempt of court for not showing up. And then they later get him on a concealed weapons charge. And that's what ends up with him getting a year in prison. And then right when he gets out, he's arrested in Miami for vagrancy. He then claimed that the Miami police were denying him food and water and threatened to arrest his family. And then when he makes those charges, they charge him with perjury because he was making it all up. Or, hey, at least they were saying he's made it up. He gets acquitted there and then goes back to Chicago where he's also arrested on vagrancy. So vagrancy you always associate with, like, it feels like homeless people are kind of laying about, maybe causing disturbances and not really doing anything, and they just kind of want to move them out of the area. They have vagrancy charges. But it also was something they would use for known criminals, because it's like, hey, you're just hanging around, and you don't have a legal job, which means you don't have a job, which means you're a vagrant, and so we're going to use vagrancy charges to kind of clear criminals out of an area, just because, yeah, you don't have a job on paper, so you're a vagrant, so we're going to arrest you. And yeah, he was convicted another time and sentenced to 6 months, but was basically free while waiting the appeals process. And that's when we kind of see him in the movie talking to the media and stuff. He's kind of out awaiting appeal and just out of another sentence. But yeah, and the actual court stuff, kind of like you talked about, it's mostly pretty boring. Although it does look like the switching juries thing, I did find a source that said that did happen at the last minute. So that kind of seems kind of like something they might have made up, since they made up everything else in the movie. It does look like they flipped juries to get the conviction. So when Capone got to prison, he was diagnosed with syphilis and gonorrhea that he'd already had for a long time. And he was going through cocaine withdrawal. So apparently he was a major cokehead the whole time, too. And he was obviously overweight, as you kind of see from the pictures of him. So when we see how shocking it is, he was only, you know, 31 in 1930. Yeah, but he looked 50, and it kind of makes sense because he was an overweight cokehead with a bunch of STDs. So life was rough for Alvin.
Right, yeah.
And as much as he was a tough guy in Chicago, he was quickly a wuss behind bars. Like, his cellmate had to protect him from bullying from the other inmates. He gets stabbed at one point. Not seriously, but the biggest issue was... he basically started to lose it mentally because of the syphilis. Because they only don't talk about like syphilis, like rots your brain or whatever.
Yes. Have you seen the Drunk History episode about Al Capone?
Oh, no. Did they talk about this?
Yeah, it's all about how his brain like rotted when he went to prison from syphilis. It's hilarious. It's only like 4 minutes long, so you should check it out after we're done with the call, because it's so funny.
Sounds cruel in the context I'm now kind of just talking medically about this guy losing his mind for syphilis, but yes, I'm sure the video is hilarious. So yeah, he actually spent like his last year in prison in mostly, assume he was sentenced to 11 years for tax evasion in 1931, so he's supposed to get out in 42, gets out early, kind of because his health is so bad, makes parole in 1939, but like there's no going back to Chicago and running the mob. Like he doesn't even know what's going on at this point. Like, he's just, his brain's basically gone. And so his health kind of ebbs and flows as he gets treatment. He moves down in Florida. Yeah, he kind of, you know, is able to spend time with his family in his final years here. But, like, dies of a, he has a stroke. And then the next day, cardiac arrest. And they said by the end, so like, a psychiatrist basically said he had the mind of a 12-year-old by the time he was done. That he just kind of just wasn't the same person. And then he's buried in Illinois. 1947 was when he died. He was 48 years old. So the other person I was going to mention, just because they used his name. So the whole cast is essentially fictional. The one other real-life person, the problem is they only use the name. So the guy who's kind of the assassin figure who Ness throws off the roof at the end for killing... Sean Connery's character.
Oh,
Frank Needy is that historical figure's name, but they just use the name. The real life Frank Needy has nothing in common with the person in the film who's kind of like stalking and threatening, and basically he's kind of like Capone's right hand man, which I guess that is the one.
Yeah, and he was not murdered by
Elliot Ness, right. Extrajudicious
by
right.
Elliot Ness in 1931.
So they just used the name. He was one of Capone's guys, but they just used the name of one of Capone's guys to then throw him in the movie, but nothing in common. So he was actually Capone's cousin. He was 13 years older than Capone. So hey, he would have been De Niro's age in the film there. So yeah, he was one of Capone's top operators, but doesn't seem to have actually ever killed anybody himself. Like, that was the work for hired guys. Like, he would have been the guy, like, a step above that, who's, like, delegating the murders out to others. He was also in prison for tax evasion, but got out before Capone even maybe went in. And so he kind of took over the outfit for Capone immediately after. So he was kind of the next boss of the outfit. Mobsters kind of going forward learned their lesson and kept a lower profile after Capone. So after Prohibition ended, they started branching out, and that's where they kind of got into labor unions, which a lot of the movies from the 1950s kind of talk about, like On the Waterfront and stuff like that. You see the mob, and that's not in Chicago, but you see the mob kind of, actually, I don't know where it's said. It could be in Chicago. But they, basically, yeah, you basically cause trouble in a labor union and then coerce money or extort money out of it for basically solving the problem you started. They also got into trouble for extorting Hollywood studios because the same kind of labor stuff. They'd cause a problem and be like, "Oh, that's a shame. You got all this trouble on your studio. We can help you out with that." Like, it was all that kind of stuff when they're causing the problems in the first place,
right?
And then Needy actually ultimately killed himself in 1943, and it's kind of unclear whether that was just to avoid prison or whether he was terminally ill or both. And there actually is an interesting Frank Needy Easter egg. So I don't remember this scene in particular. I've seen The Godfather a few times, but I guess in The Godfather, they're showing a few photos or a bunch of photos of what's supposed to be the War of the Five Families was so bad. And they show like a bunch of pictures from the War of the Five Families. Well, that's all fictional. So one of the, well, The Godfather is fictional. I don't know about the War of the Five Families particularly. But anyway, one of the pictures that they're showing is the crime scene photo from Frank Needy's suicide. And they're making it as if it was like part of the War of the Five Families.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So it's an actual photo of a crime scene there. And yeah, all the rest of the characters in the film are fictional. And we are probably about out of time. So any closing thoughts on...
I did just real quick want to mention the... You were talking about Frank Needy, and he's played by... I looked up the guy's name because I've seen him before, but I didn't know
his
name.
Oh, yeah, he looked familiar.
Billy Drago. He's in a bunch of stuff, but he's like very creepy looking dude.
Yes.
And when I was rewatching this, I was like, and he's the guy who pulls up,
right,
you know, next to Elliot Ness's house and is threatening him. It's like, yeah, that guy just looks creepy enough. Even if he doesn't say anything to you threatening or isn't committing any crime, just lock that guy up just to be safe, you know, just hedge your bets.
Yeah.
Cause that guy's going to cause problems.
Yeah. They just did a good job of the, it's the non-threat. Like,
yeah,
it isn't even like nice family shame if anything would happen to him. It's just like, that's your daughter there.
Yep.
Man should take care of his family. Like, it's just very, right, like,
yeah,
threatening, yeah, without actually even being a veiled threat. But it, yeah, anyway. Yeah. So what else was he in though? Did you see anything else?
He's a
character actor. Yeah.
Like a character actor who's been in a ton of stuff. He was in an episode of The X-Files. He's from Kansas.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hey.
Is it Hugoton?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Out west there. Yeah.
In Stevens County?
Huh.
Yep.
Yeah, it's way out west. That's like almost to Colorado. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. He has been in, oh my gosh, a ton of stuff.
I'm just, pick out maybe the ones that we would have seen.
The Untouchables for sure. Episode of The X-Files. He was in The Hills Have Eyes. He's in an episode of Supernatural. He's in Tremors 4. I don't know. He's just been in a ton of movies.
So far, nothing I would have seen.
Most of them probably like, yeah, lower budget. A lot of like sequels, like Martial Law 2 Undercover, Delta Force 2, The Colombian Connection. Yeah, I don't know. Just a guy that you've probably seen in movies before, especially if you like to watch trash like me, and creepy looking dude.
I'm just scrolling real quick. See, there we go. The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. I was a big fan of that show. It was a very short, actually. Okay, I don't know. I haven't seen it since it came out. It was pretty short. Rambo's. It's Bruce Campbell as like a really, really just kind of cool old West guy, like the, you know, like a crack shot, like just like almost like supernaturally good. Actually, the show might even get supernatural. It came out when I was in high school. It didn't last very long. I thought it was just brilliant and hilarious and fun. I don't know if it holds up at all.
Okay.
Probably doesn't. But he was one of the bad guys. Billy Drago played one of the bad guys in that.
Oh, it says he's the leader of the outlaw gang.
Yeah, yeah. So
in that show. Oh, Arlie Ermey's in it too. He's Briscoe County Senior.
Okay. I doubt it holds up. But when I was like a sophomore in high school, I thought it was so cool.
Okay, some of these names of these characters are pretty cool. Briscoe County Jr., like that's a cool name. Socrates Pool.
Yeah.
Lord Bowler, Dixie Cousins, Albert Wickwire.
Yeah, it's like I said,
those are cool character names.
It's like a comedy sci-fi western. It's fun.
All right, that sounds pretty sick.
It's probably very 90s and... But again, because it's a comedy, I think that almost makes it work. So like, if it's like, oh, it's kind of eye-rolling, yeah, it's a comedy. Just have fun with it.
I'll try to see where you can where you can stream it.
And honestly, I haven't watched it in almost 30 years here, so I'd be curious to revisit it. My mom's a big Bruce Campbell fan too, which I mean, who?
Oh, really?
I mean, who isn't, right? But she's read like his biographies and stuff.
Okay, that's funny though, because I like associate Bruce Campbell very heavily with the Evil Dead series, which I'm guessing your mom is not a fan of.
Probably hasn't seen. Yeah. Oh, because his autobiography is called If Chins Could Kill, because he's kind of known for that prominent prominent chin.
Yeah. Okay. Now I'm curious, because I'm all right. I'm guessing that your mom is not a fan of the Evil Dead series or like Army of Darkness.
I doubt she's seen it.
Okay, so what is she a fan of Bruce Campbell from then?
Probably Briscoe County Jr.
Oh, okay, all right. I didn't know. I mean, he's in other stuff.
Right, and then he does cameos and like all the Sam Raimi stuff, obviously.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It might have started with Briscoe County Jr. That's funny. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, because like, what else is he even in? He's got to have done something maybe like on TV that she would have watched after that. That's funny.
I mean, it says he's in recurring role as King of Thieves in Hercules: The Legendary Journeys, a TV show from 1995 to 1999.
I think she watched that.
Xena: Warrior Princess. He's in the TV show Burn Notice, although that's 2007 to 2013.
That's actually, I'm gonna have to ask her because that is kind of funny. Like, wait, what?
please do, because I'm honestly curious, because like I said, he's very much associated with the Evil Dead movies and Army of Darkness and all the like Sam Raimi stuff that I would think that your mom would not be a fan of at all. So now I'm curious what she has seen him in that she likes.
I'm texting you right now, and then she'll hopefully reply before we're done here.
Or maybe this is a plot twist, and like you didn't even know that your mom's like big time Evil Dead fan.
Okay, I'm saying, outside of Briscoe County Jr., how did you become a Bruce Campbell fan? But I know she's just gonna say his biography. I'm like, yeah, but why did you listen to the biography or read the biography? You don't read a biography of someone just cause, right?
You know, that would be kind of funny though. If she's, oh yeah, big Bruce Campbell fan, love his biography. Haven't seen any of his stuff. Like never watched a Bruce Campbell movie or TV show.
Well, it may just for period. So like I like Dax Shepard from his podcast. I've never seen a single thing that Dax Shepard has acted in. I just like his podcast.
Really?
Because he does crap I don't watch.
Not a single thing?
No.
You've never watched any movies with Dax Shepard? You've never seen like Idiocracy?
I haven't seen Idiocracy.
You never seen Employee of the Month?
Nope.
Without a Paddle?
Nope. I don't watch those.
Oh my gosh.
Crappy comedies that he does.
You're right. Yeah. Okay. They are pretty much like the anti-rich movie. They're all like dumb, like screwball comedy movies.
Right. And then he did like Punked or whatever after Ashton Kutcher. I never watched that real.
Ever see Knocked Up?
Oh, is he in that?
He's technically an uncredited cameo in Knocked Up.
Okay, I guess I've seen that. Okay. You got me. I'm a liar. Yeah, I just kind of know him from the podcast.
You didn't see Paw Patrol, the movie from 2 years ago?
Missed that one. Okay, can we wrap up the Untouchables here?
Yeah, we got so far off track.
Let's see. Next time is Cinderella Man, looks like. Okay. Okay, yes, but yeah, thanks for looking. Thanks for looking. thanks for listening. If you haven't already, which odds are you haven't, go sign up for our Patreon, patreon.com/historyandfilm. We're going to continue the conversation over there. We're going to talk about Ennio Morricone and a little bit of the racism towards Italians that we see from Sean Connery's character. And then I'm probably just going to talk about some of the research I was doing on medieval Scandinavia. We're going to bore Logan with that here and record that for y'all. So yeah, next time we will be discussing the Great Depression with the film Cinderella Man.